There are two sides to giving up, the virtue of sacrifice and the sin of despair. And we get mixed messages about these. You want to give up smoking or drinking or cheeseburgers? Well, that's admirable. But if you're thinking about giving up your job or your marriage or your way of life, you run the risk of being called, or calling yourself, a failure. So how do we decide which is which? That's the question psychoanalyst Adam Phillips asks in his newest book on giving up. Here's Steve Paulson.
You know, Adam, for most people, I think the idea of giving up is actually kind of shameful. We celebrate people who keep going, especially when it involves sacrifice to do something that's really hard. Clearly, you have a much more nuanced view. What made you want to start to think about giving up?
Well, I think partly for the reason you said, that there is a great deal of shame attached to it. And it occurred to me that giving up is something we should be able to do in certain situations. And that if we live in a culture, as I think we sort of do, in which persistence and seeing things through and finishing things off is highly valued, it makes giving up extremely difficult. And I think we all know from experience that clearly some relationships should be given up on. Some interests are given up on, in actuality, that our pleasures change and so on. And so I suppose I was interested in the difference between the fact that when we give something up, like, say, chocolate or alcohol, we believe we can change. And when we give up, we believe we can't.
You say the question that really interests you is not why do we give up, but why don't we give up? Which is kind of fascinating, I have to say.
Yes. I mean, I think it's linked in my mind with the way in which we're taught, or some of us are taught, to put up with things, to endure, and not to be able to consider whether actually we are really enjoying something. And in some situations, the harder it is, the better it's deemed to be. Now, clearly, you can't become an athlete or a piano player without going through a great deal of, as it were, suffering, because these skills require working through resistances. But some resistances mean you actually don't like something. It's not for you. I want to differentiate between the real difficulty of mastering something one values and a different kind of difficulty, which is giving up on something one really doesn't want to do. I can remember going to my daughter's parent-teacher meeting, and the teacher said to me, "The trouble with Mia is she only works at subjects she's interested in." And I thought, good for her.
It doesn't sound like really a problem, although I guess if you want to be a master pianist, maybe you got to push through it, even when you're not enjoying it.
But we all know we learned lots of things in school that we were not interested in, and that probably wasn't tremendously good for us.
So let's talk about what is actually involved in giving up. You say it's giving up the wanting. Can you explain what you mean?
Yes, that in a way you could think what keeps us going is our appetite. We're going to become hungry in the next hour or so. And of course, there are lots of different kinds of appetite. There's an appetite for safety. There's an appetite for protection. There's an appetite for sex. All these appetites are, in a sense, what fuel us or form us or inspire us. So it seems to me that our relationship to our desire, to our appetite, is very revealing in terms of how much we want to live, whether we want, as it were, as much pleasure and satisfaction and gratification and enjoyment as we're able to have, or whether we want as little as possible. And so it's something about people's relationship to pleasure, because the problem with pleasure is that on the one hand, it can be overwhelming. And on the other hand, if someone or something gives us pleasure, we can begin to feel dependent on them or even addicted. So pleasure is very problematic. It's on the one hand, the thing that sustains us, but it's potentially dangerous. And this is, again, something that psychoanalysis has interesting things to say about. We can be as frightened of pleasure as we are of suffering.
But the way you're talking about this, it sounds like it's deprivation. The not wanting is sort of putting aside the thing that we actually do want, but we're going to try to forget about it in some way. My sense is you're talking about something more profound to not want, to actually lose that desire in the first place.
Most of the world religions that I know about are very often about self-depriving strategies for higher ends, if you like, as though there's something about our animal nature that is a huge problem for us. And to develop, to become enlightened, to grow up, whatever our project or aim is, involves the renunciation of certain pleasures and satisfactions. Now, of course, everybody knows, having been a child, that life is intrinsically very frustrating. But it can be so frustrating that one wants to turn against desiring. Or if it's just the right amount of frustration, then, of course, that sustains our desire. We go on wanting. You know, if I'm not fed for 2 weeks, it wouldn't be odd if I began to lose my appetite. But if I'm fed every other day, I'll be hungry.
Now, in Freudian terms, he talked about the death instinct, this forbidden attraction to not living anymore. You kind of reframe this as the giving up instinct.
Well, Freud has what is in many ways is a very strange idea, which is our lives are the battle between life instincts and death instincts. There's a part of ourselves that wants as much life and as much pleasure as we can manage. And there's a part of ourselves that wants as little life as possible, that wants to anesthetize ourselves, that wants to more or less be dead or close to dead as we can, unstimulated but safe. Now, what Freud is flagging up is the possibility there is a part of ourselves that really doesn't want to live, that can't bear it. And it would seem to me everybody who is at all awake has at least had moments or periods in their lives where they have felt their lives were actually unbearable.
My sense is that for you, the death instinct is something kind of I think we all can resonate with at one time or another in our lives. I guess the question is, how deeply does that cut with most of us?
I agree with you in the sense of a great deal of work goes into deadening ourselves, to insensitizing ourselves, to inuring ourselves, say, to other people's suffering and to our own. So there's a lot of evidence, I think, that suggests that we, at least intermittently, find life unbearable. Now, the question, if you're not a religious person, the question is, what is the point of suffering? I mean, if you're a religious person, there are lots of good stories about why one might and must and should suffer. If you're not a religious person, the question is, what is the point of one's suffering? Or why go on living one's life if one's not enjoying it? And there are answers, which is some of us have children, some of us have responsibilities. Some of us want to defend values that seem very important. But on the other hand, it would seem to me there are real grounds in some lives for absolute despair. And I think that has to be part of the conversation. Otherwise, it becomes phobic. Otherwise, it's as though we've all got to be sort of more or less upbeat, and we don't feel it all the time.
To let in the despair, to acknowledge it and to talk about it, that's important.
Yes, and to see if anything can be made of it. Not assuming that everything can be transformed into something good and wonderful, but actually seeing where we go with our feelings. And that, in a way, is what psychoanalysis, a lot of the talking therapy, is about, which is finding out what it is you do happen to feel and think, and finding what you can make of it, if anything.
You write about the artist and psychoanalyst Marion Milner, who has a really fascinating take on how we think about these things, like happiness and fulfillment, and how does that figure in our lives. And she thought that a lot of it comes down to how we notice the things in our lives. And she had this distinction between what she called narrow attention and wide attention.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Yes, and I think it is a wonderful distinction. In narrow attention, it's as though we know what we're looking for and we find it if we can. And she talks about it as predatory or as full of appetite. Whereas wide-angled attention is almost what it says it is, which is you look widely without knowing what you're looking for or that you are looking for anything. So your capacity to be affected and to receive stimuli is wide open. Marion Milner, who I knew, once said to me, "When I paint a tree in a field, I look at everything but the tree." In other words, she needed to really open her eyes. And what she's saying is that we sacrifice a great deal in being focused, in having our attention overorganized. So she doesn't say one kind of attention is better than the other. She says these kinds of two different kinds of attention are better for different things.
But she's saying that if you're convinced that you know what you want going into this or what you're paying attention to, that's going to narrow.
Yes.
How you see the world. Your perceptions will be limited and it's sort of the opposite of curiosity, I guess.
Exactly, it is. And I think what's being suggested here is that there's always a temptation to narrow our minds because actually we are extremely complex and extremely receptive. it creates an anxiety in us. And so if we can find a way of narrowing our minds, it's as though there's a relief in that. But then, of course, all we've got is a narrowed mind. And you can see addiction, for example, is an acute case of this. If I think, what do I want? I want a cigarette. It's as though it has been sorted out. But in the very act of narrowing our minds, of diminishing our complexity, we lose a great deal of other wishes and wants.
So this practice of wide attention is very appealing, but it also seems pretty hard. You're talking about giving up your certainties, what is familiar in life, and embracing the unknown.
Yes, but it could even be, in a small, localized way, a very good, simple experiment in living, that you literally go outside and you don't focus on anything. You just see what you'll find yourself noticing if you don't focus. And you allow yourself not to get caught up in focusing. You allow your attention to drift. It's very like the psychoanalytic version of this is free association, where you don't speak coherently, you say whatever comes into your mind. And the speaking coherently, in a way, is an attempt to protect yourself from all the really enlivening incoherence inside you.
Are you talking about tapping into your unconscious, sort of bypassing that default mode network, sort of our rational self?
Yes, a version of that, or finding a way out of one's defensive self, or oneself as one would like to see oneself. And of course, it's very familiar in adolescence, whereas I think in a way it's where it starts. That feeling that one is really in one's body. And I think it's something to do also, strangely and paradoxically, with being able to forget oneself, to be absorbed in other people and other things. I mean, when somebody's anxious or depressed or whatever, they are self-obsessed. They have to be, because they're looking after themselves. So again, I would say the aim of, say, psychoanalysis is to enable people to forget about themselves, not to become more interested in themselves, but less interested, and therefore more interested in other people and the world.
That's fascinating, because I guess I would have guessed that the purpose of psychoanalysis is to know yourself, to gain self-knowledge.
Yes.
Sounds like that's not what you're saying, is it?
The official story is, you need to increase your self-knowledge to have the life you want. Now, it seems to me in some areas that's right, but for me, more prominently, the idea is you really need to be able to forget yourself in order to engage with other people in the world. See, I think, this is not a modest comment, I think one is the least interesting person one knows in actuality.
So we are just about at the end of this conversation here, and there was one point in your book that really struck me. You say that giving up requires a sense of an ending. What's a good ending?
Well, I think when you feel the business is finished, when you feel you've completed something to your satisfaction, when you feel it's necessary now to do something else, without feeling you've had to sacrifice something in the process.
An ending is not necessarily a sense of completion. It's something different.
Yes. It's just something has finished, and it's as though one now needs to do something else.
Adam Phillips. His book is called On Giving Up, and that was Steve Paulson talking with him.